Hello everyone, I'm Evelyn.
And I'm Lara. We are the host of Once Upon a Niger podcast, where we take you down history lane as we break down stories about people, places and events in Nigeria's past and present.
That's right, in every episode we will take you on a journey of our own discoveries as we feed our curiosity and connect with our heritage. Join us to figure out how the chronicles of the past can help write tomorrow's tale.
Hello. Hi, Evelyn. Welcome.
Hi, Lara. How are you?
I'm very good. Nice. Nice and cold. Well, I'm warm now, but yeah. It's been really cold today.
I'm not. Oh, actually, I have ventured outside today and it's just been... This weather in this UK is really tough.
These are the days when I just daydream about life back in Africa.
Listen.
And, you know, just like, let's go home. Let's pack up and go back home.
Yeah, I'm really like thinking, you know, it's really not natural, I don't think, for melanated people, highly melanated people, to spend so long in the darkness.
It's actually crazy. But anyway, we're here.
Yeah.
We're indoors. We're nice and warm.
Toasty. Yeah.
Toasty.
Thank God. Thank God.
And ready to talk about all things. Well, let's find out.
Yeah. So let's just get straight into it. Bola Tinubu.
Yes.
We're going to be speaking about his early political career, his current presence in Nigerian politics and his influence and power, and give a little bit of insight into what we think about him, what we've read so far.
So for those who haven't followed previous episodes, so this season of Once Upon a Niger, we are looking at the 2023 election. And so in the first episode, we looked at President Buhari's time in office and everything about it. And then the second episode, we looked at Atiku Abubakar. And so, yes, as Evelyn has mentioned, this episode, we are going to be talking about all things Tinubu.
There are a lot of names for this
man. Popularly known as Jagaban of Lagos.
Yes, yes. Well, for some of our listeners, what does that mean? They may not know.
I don't know. Jagaban. Jagaban is like, when I hear it, it's like, I think it's a title of like a warrior, of like someone who is a man of a man of power.
You know, I was trying to just give the floor to you because...
because I'm Nigerian.
Well, you're Yoruba, that's why. And when I researched it, it said it was a Yoruba word. And I'm not Yoruba, so I wouldn't know.
Yeah, it's a Yoruba word, but I don't... But this is the thing, it's almost like a... I mean, it's a title, but it's not like an official title of anything. It's just like a made up... I think it's a made up, you know, when you call someone, when you help people.
Okay.
So it's like Jagaban. Like, so that's literally probably, I'm trying to imagine how people would say it. Like if they're hailing him. So it'd be like, oh, Jagaban of Lagos.
If you can see Lara now, she's
my fist. It's like up, my hands in the air, and I can imagine one of those like Lagos, you know, like bus drivers or even like the politicians just raising their hands up and hailing him and all that stuff. But I think, just my intuition kind of tells me that Jagaban is like a title of, you know, just highlighting his power, the power that he holds.
So I had researched on a reliable source of Urban Dictionary that it means like a leader of warriors, a boss of other bosses.
So I think
that sort of, it definitely ties in with what you've just said. It's the spirit of the word. So I guess let's talk a little bit about like his background, and then we can get into his like foray and entry into the political sphere.
Yeah, I guess there's a lot that can be said about him, and we can start from like, oh, when he was born, his education and all of those things. But I think, you know, it's probably just worth going to like the first notable political position, like how his political career started. and the first notable political position he held in Nigeria, which was the governor of Lagos. So he was the governor of Lagos from 1999 to 2007. And so he was governor for 8 years under the Alliance for Democracy Party. And it'll be interesting to speak about all the things he did while he was governor, you know, what his time as governor was like, what were his achievements, and then we can pick up from there. So what was your understanding of his time as governor in Lagos?
Well, I think his time as governor is very mixed. So you have many people who say that he did great things for the state and are impressed by sort of the development, the economic growth of Lagos and the things that it's been able to achieve under his tenure. So the increase in electricity, like energy supply, in terms of the economy had grown. So a couple of things that I had noted, they were that he had started the Independent Power Project, and that has supplied like 270 megawatts of electricity, and that had gone to the national grid. And this was before this. Well, Nigeria is notorious for not having constant power supply. So that's something that many of his defenders say that was a positive thing he did. In terms of health, there's a program called the Blindness Prevention Program, where a lot of Lagosians were able to avoid like poor eyesight or blindness because of this program. People were receiving free eye surgeries and glasses. And then other things around like education, decentralization of power, there's a housing, there are a lot of things that he's apparently done for Lagos that have been good, that his defenders say, regardless of your opinion of him, and we'll get into that, these are some material things that he's done to improve the life of Lagosians.
And I imagine in order to appreciate all this achievement, it's probably good to paint a picture of what Lagos was like beforehand. They're probably thinking, yeah, but what is that in a grand scheme of things? But when Bola Tinubu was interviewed, for many interviews that he's done, and also from other people who were part of his party and supporting him at the time, you know, they really speak about Lagos being on the, well, Lagos was at the brink of collapse. Like, it was literally dilapidated. The city was a dump site. Literally many parts of the city was a dump site. In terms of the city's treasury and the funding that they had, you know, they were spending more money than they were making, and than was actually allocated to them by the federal government. And they also spoke about the civil service being in so much disarray as well. Like, it was really chaotic. They had people known as ghost worker. Like, so you're basically paying people for work that they're not doing. And that really spoke about the level of corruption, indiscipline that was in the civil service.
Why were there ghost workers though?
So basically, you can get a job at the civil service now, and maybe you work for like 3 months, but then because there's such a lack of discipline, nobody's checking what time you've come in, nobody's checking that you're even still working there. So you just go and do your own business. You go and be doing your own business, but then you're still getting paid as though you're working for the government. Mm. So I'm actually... I want to sell my way of people who do this, but let me not call my experts my life.
No, listen, me too. As you were saying this, I was thinking this practice is very much alive today. So
yeah, the practice is still very much alive. Probably more so in others, in some states than others. Yeah,
but the reason for that, I think, is complex though, because generally things still are very difficult in Nigeria. So yeah. And I think this is how corruption like occurs. Like, having a ghost worker, now there may be like this ghost worker phenomenon. People are not going into office and doing what they need to do because perhaps the salary is not quite enough, and so they have to do their side hustle during their job. And to be honest, around the world people do that. actually. It's, I mean, it might be particularly ripe, and then it might look, you know, it's quite pointed in Nigeria, but I think that does, like, actually...
I mean, around the world, people have side hustles, but they don't spend their employer's time doing other jobs.
No, I think so.
What, like... But then you still must be doing the job you're being paid for.
Yeah, yeah, I'm not... Yeah, so they're still,
like, you're still delivering, as opposed to, like, the person who is actually not even doing the work. Mm. So they're just getting paid because they have a name on the register.
That's true, but I mean, even the not turning up and doing the work, it's not just Nigeria that it happens. Not that I'm trying to defend defend it, but I think it's not a uniquely Nigerian thing. I think that phenomenon, I in the West, in the UK, some of us, the organisations that we're working at, we know who the ghost workers are.
Maybe it's not so much of an epidemic as it is in Nigeria and maybe other parts of Africa. I think it's definitely a lot harder to achieve ghost work in the West. It's not impossible, but it's harder to achieve compared to other parts of the world. It's not even like in this country where if you're timed out of your computer by 10 minutes, you know, it tells, like, there's a system that ensures that you're actually working.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a lot harder to achieve depending on what sector you're working in. But anyway, so that was a common practice. And people were not really paying attention to their work. People in the civil service, they just kind of had a job probably for the security that it gave them in terms of longevity, in terms of you're less likely to lose your work as a civil servant than if you worked in the private sector. You know, they spoke about it was just a jungle, and also security was such a big issue as well. Like, I remember growing up and just hearing stories of, if you go to Lagos, they can literally sell you, or you can literally, well, when I say sell you in quote, but in terms of, like, people used to get duped all the time. So I remember one time my mum, I remember a story my mum told me of how when she went to Lagos, she went to a place where, you know, to buy a watch. And so she went to the shop, they showed her the watch, everything, they put it in the box. I think they went in to, like, maybe wrap it up or something, or put it in a bag. They gave it to her. On her way out, she'd already left, perhaps on the bus or something. She opened it and there was, like, stones.
What?
Inside the box. And it's actually quite common at the time that this kind of things would happen. And I'm sure they probably still happen, but less. I think people are a lot wiser to this kind of things now. But there was a time when that was, like, a big thing, and all this other sort of, like, corrupt practices. So just to paint the picture, and also, like, infrastructure wise, a lot of things were dilapidated. You know, traffic was a madness.
Is it not still a madness?
And it's still... Well, that's what I was going to say. It's almost, like, crazy saying traffic was a madness.
Oh, in comparison to today.
In comparison to what it is now.
Yeah.
And also, like, in terms of cleanliness, in terms of the environment. Because waste management in Nigeria is already a problem. So you can imagine even back then when these things were not even in anyone's sort of consideration for the environment. So when we now speak of Tinubu's achievements, in light of those sort of problems or issues that he had to deal with,
or the extent
of those issues, then one is able to appreciate, I guess, the kind of development that he brought to Lagos. And that's why till today, Lagos is still, you know, is still put up there as one of the most advanced cities in Nigeria because of the work that he did.
But in terms of the other work, or I guess the other side of his reputation, because you'll have admirers, people who respect him, sycophants, but obviously he has his critics, and some of the criticisms are, you know, very serious. Some of the allegations, and, you know, when you read the articles and reports that have come out about Tinubu, it's, for me, it's quite alarming, I think, thinking that this man is likely to be president when there's so much mystery around him. There's so much that's unknown, or, like, quote unquote unconfirmed about him. And the allegations or the reports that I speak of are in reference to like drug dealing and wiring drug money, perjury, you know, in this election cycle.
Yeah.
Well, it's a fact that he owns like media organizations, but that proximity of, you know, owning newspapers, TV stations, and then being a politician, like there's a lot around him that when I think of him, it seems like he's a bully, or not a bully, actually, sorry. He seems like a dangerous character.
Mm.
Like he seems like sinister. So I was trying to come in with, you know, come into researching about him with as much as possible, not neutral, but fair analysis or view of him. But man, that phrase, there's no smoke without fire. I mean, to me, it's given squint my eye when I'm looking at his records.
Yeah, I think, and that's the thing about his person, you either love him or you hate him. And the people who really love Tinubu in Lagos, in Nigeria generally, and then those who hate him or dislike him, should I say, they really, really dislike him for different reasons. But just before I kind of touch on like some of the, you know, sort of bad things or negative aspects of his governance, it's kind of worth dwelling a little bit on, because I think part of the things that gave him his political tools and has made him really a political giant, if I may say, is the sort of way he put governance structures in place while he was governor. He really, not only was a governor, he also ensured that he became a critical player in appointing future governors. And sometimes I think that's the problem with how progress is made in Nigeria, where it's almost like a godfatherism thing, right? But for him, it served well and it's also served in a very bad way for Lagos and for Nigeria. So the changes he made, the infrastructures, him inviting like private companies to come in to Nigeria to really make assets out of the liabilities that the state had in order to generate revenue for the state in order to fund all of these developments. Like people go to Lagos now and they speak of the fantastic infrastructures. In many places, they speak of the new, you know, the developments in places like Lekki, where, you know, years ago, those places were probably non-existent. They speak of like, you know, the bridges that were constructed, all of these different things. And it was on those foundations that subsequent governors kind of built. So we think of like Governor Fashola, who took over from Bola Tinubu. And I think one thing he has really done and succeeded at, rightly or wrongly, is just kind of having people to carry on the work that he felt he started, and almost having a control over them. And so that's where this kind of like godfatherism has come. But I really do, one of the things that I will give him credit for when I was doing my research and reading is really the creativity with which he created revenue for Lagos State. And one of the things he said himself, he was, no matter how brilliant you are and no matter how brilliant your idea is, it dies on the shelf of thinking if you cannot back it with revenue. This made him go beyond and turn around the financial fortune of Lagos from like literally 600 million naira in 1999 to 8 billion naira in 2007 before he left it. That is huge. And you have to give him credit, because I don't know of any other governor in Nigeria who has done that. Because if they can do that, then a lot of the states in Nigeria would be much better than they are. They won't be perfect, because Lagos itself is not perfect. And that's one of the things I always say when people say, oh, go to Nigeria, you know, Nigeria is wonderful. But a lot of the times what they mean is go to Lagos. Lagos is wonderful. And so Lagos has almost become synonymous, or Lagos is sort of this emblem for the whole of Nigeria. And I was always, I remember, like, I'm always very quick to like remind people, no, you mean Lagos, not Nigeria, because the whole of Nigeria still needs a whole lot of work. But And that's to acknowledge, like, without what Tinubu has done and all the other governors after him, nobody will be speaking of Lagos or even Nigeria in the same way that they do now. So, but like you said, there's no smoke without fire, because with all the revenue generation and all the development, I'm sure he wasn't just doing it out of the pure generosity of his heart. So, yeah, what did he have to gain for himself? Like,
well, I think there was a lot to gain for himself. I think, well, there are a few things, I suppose, that make me cautious about that. That's, I guess, give me a more sober review of like who he is as a candidate. And I think that's in relation to the more recent reports that have come out about him. And there's a very thorough report by David Dane about Tinubu's story from when he was a student in the US, like based in Chicago, working in consultancy as an accountant, and the shenanigans and like dark aspects of him being like the accountant for some drug dealers in the US. And there was an indictment against him, actually. I mean, he has a history of lying and like making very public like lies. And so, for example, some of them are around when he was an accountant working at Deloitte. So he said that he was like, early on in his career, he was a fantastic accountant. I think he'd been working at Deloitte for 5 years. And he said that he was paid a bonus of $850,000 at the time. Yeah, Lara is looking confused right now.
That is a lot of money. What, for being the executive director or what?
No, not
for
even
being an accountant.
That's the question, Lara. That's the question that everybody's like, huh? But like, he actually stated this very proudly and boldly and said that he had been paid this money. Now, to give it some context, like a consulting partner at Deloitte, this is like the top, you know, salary that one can get. They can get a remuneration of like almost $600,000 as a salary. And then, like, no, sorry, not as a salary, but their salary plus any bonuses. Like, that's the maximum amount that a consulting partner can get. And so for somebody who's like 5 years into their career, and at the time he was saying he got this bonus, he was like a junior accountant, it causes one to question, how is that possible? And this journalist had spoken to Deloitte and said, has this guy ever worked for you? And they said, this person has never been on our records. What would make
you... That's what I'm thinking, because in all of the research I've done, there's very little, I hadn't seen anything that said he worked at Deloitte.
But that's something that
he had claimed.
Yeah. That's something that he claimed he did. Then you have the drug dealing. And so in 1993, like, he was, I think, handling like drugs and I'll link the article. It is a long read,
yeah,
but it is a very thorough article and there's a lot of evidence.
Yeah.
So within the article, there's lots of links to documents and screenshots of documents, and this reporter has spoken to people who worked in the US around that time to sort of verify some of the claims that Tinubu has made, and it just seems very sketchy.
Yeah.
Seems very sketchy. Now this is a point about character and ethics of the man, right? Drug dealing and being involved in that in any capacity, serious question mark. You're lying about your salary, question mark. Why would you lie about that stuff? But then also additionally, like, as I mentioned before, the ownership of media platforms, and there's nothing wrong with owning like a media company. But when you're in government and then you're owning stations that influence and impact the citizens to a serious like extent,
yeah,
that's also very questionable. And obviously there's the responsibility of the Fourth Estate of journalists to behave appropriately. But That tells me, that makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah. And it's a tool for propaganda, because at the end of the day, if you own a TV station, you might speak of the journalist on the, you know, the journalist broadcasting on the station, but that won't be the only thing they broadcast on the station, right? So there's a TV show on, because the name of this TV station is called TVC Communications. So there's a TV show on the station called Your View TVC, and it's basically a host of a panel of women, of like maybe 5-6 women at different times, usually 4 of them on the show at a time, where they talk about a huge range of different things. And they're not investigative journalists, they're not even journalists by any stretch of the imagination, but people continuously criticize them for upholding Tinubu's agenda just because they are host on his show. And so even when, and part of the things they do on their show is like they do like newspaper reviews, and in the newspaper review they obviously have to like talk about all the news headlines and give their opinions and criticize governments. They sometimes call government officials on the shows to like question them, interrogate them, all of these different things. But the validity, or should I say the legitimacy, of their show is often called to question because the show is being aired on a station that is owned by Tinubu. So they often question, you know, do you genuinely care about these things, or are you just, you know? But kind of going back to the drug incident you mentioned, to give a bit of information, so you're right, he was indicted by the US court and for drug trafficking and money laundering, and he actually forfeited $460,000 to the United States, especially the states of Chicago, and because they deemed the money to be proceeds of crime. And one of the things that they found was that at the time, the court revealed that Bola Tinubu owned 10 bank accounts that was used in drug trade. And it's just like, why would, I mean, all things aside, I don't know how many bank accounts one individual needs to own, but when you own 10 bank accounts...
And not just him, his family members as well. It was a family enterprise.
Mm.
I think his mother, he opened a bank account on behalf of his mom as well, like...
Yeah,
so very shady.
So there was all these things going on, and apparently he was also in business with another very well-known Nigerian drug trafficker. So yeah, so he forfeited the money, and I think the idea of him forfeiting the money was meant to be some sort of indication of guilt, whereas like if you know you've earned that money genuinely, that you don't forfeit it, you continue to fight to reclaim your money. But other aspects of like the negative aspects of his governance, and so going back to lies, so you're talking about lies about his job, about what he was earning. There's even currently like question marks around his age, because he claims to be 70 years old, but people are like, with, you know, they're like, you are my great grandfather.
So I did see articles doubting his age. And I think it's a problem, but I suppose when I saw that criticism leveled at him, I did wonder, but what's the impact of that? There are many Nigerians who don't know their age. It's a couple of years off because of the nature and the circumstances that they were born in, and there wasn't proper documentation when they were born. So
then, but shouldn't he just claim that he doesn't know his age if he doesn't have a birth certificate?
But you know, there's big man, there's pride, there's all of that.
Because if Buhari can know his age, there's no reason why Bola Tinubu should not know his age.
I don't know.
And even there's also, so when I was researching, there was also like claims about him lying about what state he's actually from. So you know, you can't be a governor of a state if you're not from that state.
Right.
So he therefore has to be from Lagos State in order to be a governor of Lagos State. But apparently, he's actually from Osun State. Mm. And so, I mean, this could be a conspiracy, you know, or just, I don't know. But there's actually legitimate conversations going on online about what state he's actually from and how he has created this profile for himself to fit into the idea of him being from Lagos State and his mother being the Iyaloja of, you know, being the Iyaloja, the market woman, the market leader of Lagos State. There's also lies about the schools he went to. So like his primary and secondary education, like they were saying that they couldn't even find traces of those education institutions that he claimed to have gone to. So nobody knows whether legitimately he went to those primary and secondary schools. And that then calls into question the certificates that he was able to use to enroll himself in college in America and in the... Because I think he went to Chicago State University, but there's also University of Chicago.
Yeah, so he said that there was a mistake. Someone in his team made a mistake, apparently. So they put one university instead of the other.
Which isn't, I can see that being a... Chicago State University, University of Chicago.
I mean, yeah, sure. But I mean, if you're operating, yeah, at the level of... If you're hoping to operate at the level of governorship, like, come on, man. Like, get your act together.
Yeah.
Like, also, like... Anyway,
you'd expect a top team that kind of get the information together. So one of the things I struggle with in regards to him is the nepotism that he practices. So for example, when his mother, I want to say his supposed mother, because we don't know if he's actually from Lagos or not, but who he claims to be his mother and who everybody acknowledges to be his mother, Madame Tinubu, when she passed away and because of her position as the market leader, mm-hmm. or I guess officially, I don't know what the title is, like President General of Market Women, basically in English. When she passed on, the position that became vacant, right, to be filled again. And in a democratic state, it's not a family, it's not an inheritance. You don't inherit the position. It's open for everybody to kind of like vie for it, to be elected for that position. But rather than have that position come up for election, he appointed his 40-year-old daughter, who is not even a market woman or anything like that, to become the leader of this market women and traders in Lagos. So without giving the others the opportunity, without actually giving those women the opportunity to elect their own leaders. And his 40-year-old daughter is now the leader of all this, you know, old market women, people who have been there even probably before she was born or something like that. And people speak about the totalitarian sort of regime that she runs and how, and I think he's made a lot of strategic decisions in actually how he has appointed people in positions. Because when you want to win an election in Nigeria, one of the key people you need are the market people. If you have the vote of the market people, and many of whom are illiterate, I'm sure there are some educated people amongst them, but by and large, illiterate people, when you can control them, you can control a big part of the population.
Mm.
And so with his daughter now in this very key position, apparently one of the things she's been doing is she's been demanding that these traders and market women show evidence of the APC registration as a condition for them to reopen shops. So she asked all of them to close their shops and in order for you to open it. So it's like you're wielding your position as a way of manipulating people to vote for your party or to be a party member. And yeah, she's just been doing all kinds of things and she doesn't have a good reputation. The other thing he did was he put his wife as a senator. So because of how much power he wields in the political space in Lagos in particular, he has now become some sort of chief selector of candidates for elections year in, year out. So if you don't do his bidding, you're out. And a case in point was the governor before the current governor. So this current governor is called, what's his name? This current governor is called Sanwo-Olu. Governor Sanwo-Olu. The previous governor is called Governor Ambode. Now, Governor Ambode only did one term, 4 years. Now, normally you would want to go for a second term, and one of the measures of your success is if you actually do two terms. Now, the one of the talks is that Governor Ambode started to grow wings Governor Ambadeh was probably growing wings and trying to do things his own way and not to be too influenced by this, you know, godfather, as it were. But Tinubu had to show him, I'm still your master. And so second term came, they were not supporting Ambadeh. And so Sanwo-Olu is now became governor. So those are the kind of like, you know, strategies and just ways that he has sort of maintained his relevance in politics, even though he hasn't been a politician since 2006. So his wife is the senator, in Lagos. And then he also appointed his son to like another position, or, you know, he's an advertising guru for State Account. So they've got their hands in a lot of major positions and, you know, political and also, I guess, even in terms of the private sector as well. So that's Tinubu in a nutshell in terms of his governance and who he's been so far. And I even forget to mention, you know, people question his source of wealth. So there has been this theory, well, not theory, in 2019, it was said that they saw like 2 bullion vans driving into his house. And it's like, the only thing that can be in a bullion van is money. And unless you are a banking institution, you shouldn't have a bullion van driving into your establishment.
I think there was a documentary actually about this controversy and about the way he was managing money. I think it's called Lord of Baudelaire.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I think that's... It's giving me French and I'm not pronouncing it properly. But yeah, I saw a documentary. There's a documentary about that. But then he sued the filmmakers. So the filmmakers were from a network called AIT.
And
he sued them for like millions or maybe billions in Naira. And the documentary couldn't be filmed again. And then they came to some sort of settlement because he was saying that this is defamation of character or whatever. So...
Yeah,
that's him.
Yeah, I guess as apart from him known as the Jagaban of Lagos, one of his other titles is Lion of Bodilon. I think it's Bodilon. I don't know. I think that's how you say it. And I think Bodilon is like where he lives. Like he's.
Oh, okay. So maybe it's not French.
Lion of Bodilon. I think so. When you look at his house, because I was trying to figure out why they call him that. So I think like maybe you know how people call, like how you have number 10 or whatever, and like people name the houses and stuff. So I think that's So I think it's called Lion of Bodilon, but it's also called the Ashiwaju of Lagos. And Ashiwaju basically means the forerunner, if I interpret that correctly. Yeah, but yeah, there's been a lot of questions about his source of wealth and how he has basically turned a lot of Lagos public assets into his own personal, into his personal assets, and at least is making money from them, which isn't too far-fetched, because with someone who's an accountant and of his financial prudence, I can imagine him putting structures in place as such that his entire generation are never gonna be poor, because they've acquired so much of the national assets for themselves.
But should a criminal be allowed to govern?
But is he a criminal?
He's a drug dealer.
But was he convicted?
Oh, come on. It's not the conviction that matters. When the evidence is clear. That's like asking, like, it's clear Trump has done things that are, like, of criminal nature.
Yes.
So, but nobody, well, some, obviously there are... There are his sycophants who are like, yeah, he should. Anyway, he's even coming back, isn't he?
Well,
he apparently he's announced his campaign again.
Yeah,
but a lot of Americans and a lot of people around the world, like, this man should not.
But they're still gonna vote for him. They're gonna vote for him. I mean, who would have thought that Donald Trump would be president the first time round? Not to speak of conceiving of the idea of coming back a second time round. Ideally speaking, so. You get the president you vote for, you deserve in many ways, because who are the people voting, right? So yeah, I mean, yeah, you can speak of should a criminal, but then who has clean hands in the Nigerian political space, really and truly?
Well, there may be one.
Well, like Peter will be. Let's come back. We'll come back to that on another episode. But so let's speak quickly of just what Tinubu is promising Nigerians for the 2023 election. What can we expect from his government? How is he going to make Nigerians' lives better?
Well, the campaign is titled A Renewed Hope 2023. And I feel as though across the campaign manifestos or whatever has been divulged from the candidates, you know, they're saying they're going to restore and fix, you know, it actually sounds very similar to me. A lot of the areas, you know, we're going to address national security, we're going to improve the economy, we're going to address agriculture, power, oil and gas, women's rights and education, etc. And so I just think, to me, I actually find it difficult to, sometimes I think the person and the nature in which they have governed in the past is probably more, it's like a better indication of how they would govern, you know, at the peak and pinnacle and in that ultimate position of president, because a lot of the areas that they're campaigning on, they're all saying the same thing.
Yeah,
because it's the same situation all around. Yeah, you know,
it's almost like they all have the same ideas because they know this is what Nigerians want, or this sounds good, whether they can execute that or not. Because for me, as far as I'm concerned, it's almost like you're saying this in a different language to what Buhari used. He promised all of these things, but whether they can execute it or not, or whether they have the will or the capacity to execute these things. And one thing that I found a bit off-putting with his manifesto is just how long it is. It's like 80 pages long, not because it was detailed, because I looked at it. I mean, 80 pages of, when you take it with the font size and all of that stuff, it didn't go into any great detail. And it kind of all sounded like airy-fairy about all the nice things that they're going to do without going. I'd rather, because I don't think what Nigeria needs right now, it's like a 20 point, I'm going to achieve all these 20 things for you. To be honest, maybe I'm being, what's the word? Maybe I'm being idealistic or just not really understanding the complexity of governance and what goes into it. But for the next president of Nigeria, I think they need to have like a limited focus. They need to be focused on like maybe five things that we can hold you to. Mm. We can say, you said you're going to do this, point one, and these are the ways you said you're going to execute them. Are they measurable? Are they, you know, what's that thing in science where something is only scientific when you can measure it and you can analyze it and all of these different things. And so if there's no measurable success, there's no indices of measurable success, then we've got nothing to hold you to really, you know. So I mean, so he's got that manifesto and some people have criticized him actually. So Dele Momodu, is the strategic communications director for PDP, for the PDP party, and he has criticized Tinubu's manifesto as half thoughts, poor reasoning and copied notes. So he reckoned he copied Nkeo Abiola's 1993 Hope 93 manifesto. I don't know, we talked about Abiola in one of our previous episodes in season one. So, I mean, I think for me though, personally, one of the highlights of his campaign so far was one of the speeches he gave in his early days of when he was, I believe at the time, he was still vying for his party to select him as the candidate for APC. And so they'd gone to one of these party events and he was basically speaking about how it's his turn. And he spoke of his turn as though he was an entitlement, like, this is my father's house and it's my turn to be, you know, it's almost like a monarchy. Like, you know, Prince Charles can speak of his turn because everybody knows what the structure is. But this is a nation. This is not your inheritance. But some of the reasons, so like he basically kind of highlighted some of the things we've been talking about in terms of like godfatherism. So he spoke about how Buhari wouldn't have been president without him. He said he was the one who was instrumental in Buhari being president. And he highlighted how, you know, the first time Buhari ran, he failed. The second time Buhari ran, he failed. And then the third time, and then Buhari became this person who was crying on national television. And he went to visit Buhari and he said to Buhari, oh, you don't have to cry. Don't worry. I am going to secure your leadership as long as you promise not to play with the Yoruba people, or to, you know, to, you don't play with the Yoruba land, in quotes. So he promised that to Buhari, and he said, so this time around, it's my turn. And he said, so he said in Yoruba, and this became a meme. I mean, Nigerians make fun of everything, to be honest, but I guess if they don't, they're just going to be in a state of perpetual misery. So he said, Emiloko, and he was saying it, like, he repeatedly highlighted how it's my turn. I wish you understood Yoruba, because it was literally like, it leaves you just kind of like perplexed. Like, this is not a company. And it's not a monarchy, you know. And he talked, then he further went on to say, you know, these people, I'm going to stop protecting these children. So he spoke like a father. And the children he's speaking of are some of the governors, some of the senators, the people that he has helped to put in positions. And he was said, it's enough. It's my turn. Me too. I want to be president. And he said, this one behind me. And he literally used the word, this one behind me. And he was referring to one of the governors, Governor Dapo Abiodun, I think he's a governor of Ogun State or something. He said, this one behind me. He wouldn't be governor without me. That's right. And then, you know, when the camera showed behind him, then they showed the face of the governor he was talking to. And then they showed the face of the governor of Lagos State. And you can tell that the governor of Lagos State just prayed that, please don't mention my name. It's like, don't mention my name. But yes, so I think, you know, Tinubu, is literally, I think he's taking this election like it's his own. And I think it's also kind of reflected in the amount of effort they've put into campaigning and even in engaging in political debates or even engaging the citizens. You know, they understand sort of like the right people who need to be paid, who need to be encouraged, because he has laid the groundwork and he's fairly confident that this election is his to win. The victory belongs to him. And I wonder if you think the victory belongs to Tinubu.
That's an interesting question, actually, because the first answer that came to mind was, yes, actually, the victory does belong to him, because whether or not you like him, he has put in the work. Whether it be, you know, in ethical ways, he's actually acted like a politician. He's very Machiavellian. Like, he knows who to bribe or whatever. I'm sure that's occurred. But like, who to court, who to help, who to lord over the favors that they, you know, he's done for others. And so I think in that respect, yeah, the victory does belong to him, because he showed himself to be quite an astute politician.
Yeah.
Whether or not it is right for him to be president, I don't know. I think for me, it almost feels inappropriate to say whether or not, because I'm not in Nigeria. I'm not living,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm not living under these policies, under these governor type people, you know. I'm not experiencing it. But his ethics, his character is in serious questions for me. And sometimes I wonder, am I just looking at this, and I'm sure in many ways I am, but am I just looking at this, you know, with the naivety of a Westerner, you know, think, you know, under this so-called, I'm living under a so-called democracy, but there are many ways in which the machinations of politics, the way it runs here, is actually very similar to what you see in Nigeria. It's just that in Nigeria, yeah. they don't have shame. I think that's probably even the difference. And this country is even catching up with the shamelessness.
The shamelessness, exactly.
So I guess right now I'm a bit confused, you know, because they're doing the things that most politicians do, actually. I suppose for me, I'm becoming more accepting or submitting. I'm submitting to the fact that the true reality of this politics, and I can't, you know, look down on the politics of Nigeria or pretend that where I'm coming from and my experience of politics and the way I'm being governed is now like better than what's going on in Nigeria. But with that being said, where I am currently and with all the experiences that I've had and the way I experience politics and see things and elections happen from the outside, I'm like, no.
Yeah.
No. But again, I think there's still a way to go in the progress of politics and the engagement and the rooting out and punishing, actually, you know, bad behavior. I think there's still a way to go in that respect. So I think the reality is, yes, he's going to, well, yeah, I think it's highly likely that he will win. And it's all, I feel, I don't know if this is cynical, but I feel as though it's almost like whether or not he should, whether or not it's right, that's not even the question. It's more about, okay, what good has come from the election more generally, like in terms of the engagement of, you know, the electorate, like how engaged are they? That's a more interesting, I think, important question for me. Regarding the road to 2023.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And I think that there's obviously the ideal and there's the reality, and I'm no longer vying for the ideal because the ideal is just not, it's pretty non-existent. When you survey like all the candidates and all the parties and all the people in the political sphere, I think for me, the reality is that absolute morality is not a player at the table.
Mm.
You're just not going to get that politician who is as white as snow, who one can say they are without sin, let this person be the savior of Nigeria's political life. But I do believe that Tinubu has the capacity to govern Nigeria. He has the political will. He's got everything. Like you really said, he's politically astute and he has really put everything in place for him to come and kick things off. And like I've heard a lot of Nigerians say, we're not saying don't steal, we're just saying steal with a bit of conscience. That's all they're asking for, because to think that there's going to be a politician right now or president who's not going to, you know, put their hands in their own pocket from the national treasure, that's going to be us in cuckoo land. They're going to steal. But let's have good roads. Let's have security. Let's have some sensible infrastructure that would allow us to benefit also from being citizens of this country. And so, yeah, so that's Tinubu for us in this episode. For those who don't know about him, I hope this has given you a bit of enlightenment. And for those who already know, let us know what you think about this episode. You know, do you agree with us? What are your opinions about Tinubu? Do you think he's going to win? Yeah, and then do share this episode as well. Share it all around to inform others about the candidates for the 2023 election. So thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. Bye.
Ciao. So guys, thank you for listening to this episode. We hope you enjoyed it and learned a thing or two.
Yep, you can find our episodes on Spotify, YouTube, Apple, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to keep up with us in between episodes, you can follow us on Instagram at Once Upon a Niger.
You can also find links to some further reading and information about the episode's topic in the show notes. If you want to encourage, collaborate, or as I like to say, support the ministry, drop us an email at onceuponaniger@gmail.com. Bye for now.
Bye.